because we're done.
Yeah.
Oh, now, guy goes in and he says, yeah, when you see a name like O'Malley, most of the Irish people are going to vote for O'Malley. That's a matter of fact. I think you can establish things.
Right.
Okay. Now, the next name down the list is some guy by the name of Milano. All right. And that's a ethnically identifiable Italian name. So, okay. A lot of people would say, I don't vote for Italians. They'd say all kinds of other curse words, all kinds of other things. Say, no, I vote for that guy, you know. And the next one's a readily identifiable German name. And I can say, hey, I'm Krauss, you know, so and so forth. So they don't vote for that guy. But what happens is, most of the Irish will vote for an Irish name. Most of the Italians will vote for an Italian name. Most of those Germans are going to vote for that guy. And then the Jewish name. Jewish names are very popular in large urban areas.
Yeah.
And a lot of individuals will vote for an individual based on solely upon this ethnicity. And that Jewish name is going to get most of the Jewish vote.
And they tell it from the name.
Right. They tell it from the name. They don't know anything else about this guy. But they know that at least he's one of their own, supposedly.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of these aren't. Because the guy, you go down the line, there's some guy by the name of Riley. Oh, Riley, what the hell? It's an Irish name. You get a lot of Irish vote for this black fellow who has an Irish name.
Yeah.
So, and I've even noticed guys, and I know a particular individual who changed his name to Flanagan. And his name was, it just slips me right now, but it's a German.
Okay.
And he changed his name to Flanagan, appeared on a ballot. Sought to be elected that way, and he got a lot of votes. But he got in a contest with a lot of other individuals, including a couple other Irish names, and so, you know, the vote gets diluted.
Yeah.
And so, if you watch what's happening, he didn't get elected, but he made every effort to do that. So, some ways you don't know exactly what you're voting for, but that happens, you know. So I don't think I really was going to get a lot of ethnic Irish voting for me just because my name is close, because they don't think most of them know that.
Yeah.
But then, see, a lot of them don't understand that, you know, names that don't sound Irish are very much Irish, especially names like, well, you take a name like Mulholland. Everybody knows that Mulholland and many are Irish names, but they don't understand the fact that those names have been Irish for long periods of time. But those people moved all the way through the Dutch area.
Yeah.
And the Mull is a prefix that basically, and Holland tells you exactly
sure.
where they came from.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know. And Mulvaney, V-A-N, the van, you know, is mm-hmm. also a Dutch prefix. And you take a name like McElhaney, E-L-D-O-N, and that's right out of the Spanish, El Don Juan. And that's where that comes in Irish ethnicity. And so those are really basically Irish names. And so we know that, those Fitzgeralds, and that's the French prefix there, Fitz. And, you know, even John Fitzgerald Kennedy. You know, those names, you've got to know and understand those things that you find. Names like Devereaux, like Duchesne, like DeGrasse, like Dyra,
mm-hmm.
You know, all kinds of, these are common Irish names
yeah.
that most non-Irish, certainly not a lot of Plastic or Erskine's Irish here in Chicago or around there, they have this fascinating mm-hmm. Irish names. So, it helps to have something that looks like it's attractive to a large number of people. And that's why, you know, lately you find a lot of people running for office here in Cook County. And, you know, the regular Democratic organization is as strong as it was years ago. So they're not able to control the bottom of the ballot as they were before.
Yeah.
And I did distinguish between top and bottom of the ballot, because a lot of people finish.
Mm-hmm.
And down there, this, that these offices aren't stressed as much. So you find all kinds of strange things happening down there. You find that people, well, as I say, will vote for and against the things without knowing too much about them.
Mm-hmm.
We know now, and I've known for a long time, that you got an Irish name like Murphy, you're a wire, and you're running for office. You'll get Irish, most of the Irish, you'll also get most of the Italian.
Mm-hmm.
The Italians are a large head of the group of the city of Chicago. They'll vote for them.
Okay.
Because they have a particular cultural animosity.
Yeah.
And you'll also get a lot of the Jewish vote, because you're not running against a guy by the name of Einstein or something like that, which is identifiably Jewish. If you're running one-on-one, the Jewish vote would be for Einstein.
Mm-hmm.
Murphy or McGuire,
yeah.
But if there's no Einstein on the ballot or anything that looks like that, you're going to get, no matter who your opponent is, you're going to get the Jewish vote.
Okay.
So you get the Irish vote, you get the Italian vote, you get the Jewish vote, you know.
Sure.
And so that's very handy. There are ethnic animosities that exist between these other ethnic groups that don't exist in an awful lot of extent against the Irish, and that's why a lot of these individuals are running with these Irish names in Chicago. It's just a phenomenon, maybe, that you see out there, but that's basically why it happens. And today, I would say that my chances in the Democratic primary, if I had the endorsement of a regular Democratic organization, probably be pretty good with a name like Pelosi, because, as I say, there are a lot of people that are going to vote against me because they dislike me,
right,
for ethnic grounds. You know what the hell I am.
Right.
And if they see the name up there,
uh-huh,
and they see it close, and I'm running against a guy by the name of Milano, and they don't like Italians,
right,
they're going to vote for me.
Sure.
If they are Italian, they're going to vote for Milano. And if they're neither Italian or you know, they don't know what they or anti-Italian.
Right.
You know, then I got a 50-50
sure
shot anyway.
Sure. Victory by default.
So it's not a bad ethnic name today. And then I would have the precinct captains of the regular Democratic organization for what they might be worth today. And it's certainly not as strong as they were in a time that I ran. They'd be out working for me. So,
yeah.
So you know, the regular Democratic organization has been very helpful, and I have no a reluctance to having been endorsed by that organization or sought their endorsement. Say that that's politics, and that's how it happens in this city. And
sure,
I've been a beneficiary of it. And God bless the late Mayor Richard J. Daley and the old regular Democratic organization, the way that existed. I have
yeah
no problem with that.
Okay. Let's take a. Okay, we're back talking with Judge Michael Close. This is Bjorn Skapson and Chris D'Amato. Let's move on to when you were elected to the bench and you worked in the criminal division starting in 1976. And what was it like? Can you briefly describe what it was like in the criminal division in the 70s? What did you encounter when you first got onto the bench in the criminal division?
Well, when I was first assigned to the criminal division at the end of 1976, early 1977, the presiding judge of the criminal division, Judge Richard Fitzgerald, had decided to employ a fast-track set of courtrooms consisting of four courtrooms in which individuals charged with violent felonies would be fast-tracked. That is, the decision was made to set up four courtrooms within the criminal division that would hear only cases in which individuals charged with serious violent felonies would be tried expeditiously with respect to those offenses, and that they would have to qualify to be on that qual by having had previous violent criminal histories, and that they would have had to have been sentenced at least twice before to the to incarceration in the NOMI or other similar departments of corrections within the United States to qualify them to be on that particular call. So, as a result of that, what had been holding back some of the dispositions within the criminal division was that many judges would have these individuals on their call within the criminal division, and they were starting to clog up their calls because these individual cases, the defendants were not willing to negotiate pleas and move the call along, possibly, but would hold out for protracted trials, and that way, the presiding judge felt that by assigning them to these four courtrooms, that those judges would day in and day out be trying felony criminal trials.
And this is
because the defendants weren't inclined to plead guilty.
This is what you call the recidivist call?
This was a recidivist call. And had very, very, very few pleas of guilty. Most of the individuals on this call were found guilty by juries. It was the only way to move the call. It was understood what was going on here by both the court, the prosecution, and the defense. The defendant's attorney obviously was trying to properly posture his client's cause, but the situation was such that if he were to attempt to negotiate a plea, the court would come back with a recommendation of some considerable period of incarceration, a lot more time than the particular defendant was willing to plead to. Now, defendants would possibly be offered 20 or 30 years, and appropriately so, to the particular charge, and maybe even considerably more time than that. And most criminal defendants who have been in the system for any period of time, they have an understanding of exactly what's facing them, what's going to happen once they go into the Illinois Department of Corrections, which is prison, and they are going to do everything they possibly can to not get there. One thing being going to a jury trial and lucking out with a jury finding not guilty, which is oftentimes pretty remote. In many of these cases, many of these defendants are not indeed the brightest individuals in the world. They've had confederates, and there's all kinds of people blabbing and telling stories on them, and they are deep, deep, deep in the mire of the whole thing. There's a lot of evidence stacked up against them, but they're hoping against hope that maybe a jury will cut things loose. And, yeah, it does happen, but it doesn't happen very often. So with that being the case, they still want to go to trial. So we went to trial. There was an accommodation of these individuals, and I had a very, very busy trial calendar. I was trying at that time, case after case after case, and oftentimes I was trying two cases at the same time, maybe three cases at the same time, with recessing one, continue with the other, and having more than one or two juries, and possibly three juries going at one time. It was a very, very heavy schedule. I started early in the morning, and I went late into the afternoon, early evening, and juries out, yeah, early morning to late at night. We're considering verdicts while other cases were being tried. The jury room was being occupied, and sometimes have two jury rooms for deliberations at the same time as I was trying another case.
So you had the jury in the room while you had a trial going on?
I had to borrow other judges' jury rooms in order to have juries deliberating in other jury rooms. At the time, I was trying a third case to another jury. This went on to all hours. Oftentimes, those juries would deliberate at 7 or 8, 9 o'clock at night before they were sent to a hotel to be sequestered and returned the next morning at 9 o'clock and be in the jury room continuing to deliberate. Sometimes I had juries out, I'd send them to a hotel maybe at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the evening, have them fed, and allow them to deliberate until 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night, and then retire for the evening.
Yeah.
And to return to the jury room after they were at breakfast at the hotel, and recommence deliberations at 9:30 in the morning in the jury room. I preferred to have these juries continue to deliberate without interruption day after day, including Saturday and Sunday if necessary, and over holidays. Unlike, as I see in this Peterson case right now, the judge allowed the sequestered jurors not to deliberate for 2 days over the weekend, past weekend, and now he's again allowing them not to deliberate because of his power of Veterans Day. So these things didn't happen. I'd have juries come back maybe at 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. I'd go down from my home to the courthouse and take those verdicts at maybe 11:30 at night, discharge the jury, and continue on the next day with another jury trial. So it was a very heavy schedule, and it was accomplishing the desired effect of the presiding judge, Richard Fitzgerald, who initiated the system after having taken a look at similar program in Boston, Massachusetts, where it likewise had proved successful, and it did help in reducing many cases that were clogging up calendars in the criminal court, thereby freeing up a lot of other judges to continue to dispose of cases by bench trials and pleas of guilty. I had very few bench trials in those days. Bench trials in cases in which the defendant surrenders his right to a trial by jury, waives that, says I'd rather have the court hear the case. I feel that my case would be better postured before a judge sitting without a jury.
Right.
And people often do that because they feel that, and their lawyers often feel that the legal questions that are involved would better be decided by a judge than any of the emotional factors involved in the case if presented to a jury would possibly cause that jury to find the client guilty, whereas a judge looking at the facts in the case, considering the law, would probably maybe be in a position, a better position to find his client not guilty, and that's why they do that.
Okay.
So there's a distinction between a jury trial and a bench trial, and that's what it is. So it had the desired effect and did significantly free up those other courtrooms and reduce the number of cases. In the criminal division, that, as I say, we're slowing it down. About 1983, I had been, this recidivist call, incidentally, was being held at 1340 South Michigan Avenue in a building that had been acquired by the county and outfitted with courtrooms. And four of the courtrooms inside of that building were
appropriated by the criminal division for specifically its recidivist call.
Okay.
And I said I had a recidivist call at that location. In about 1983, the recidivist call, having accomplished what the presiding judge had intended it to, and the remodeling at 26th Street having been accomplished so as to enlarge the number of courtrooms at that facility, the recidivist call was, as it then existed, disbanded, and I was given a regular call within the criminal division.
Okay.
There weren't enough courtrooms at that time at 26th in California to move all of the courtrooms that were then at 26th in California, or at 13th in Michigan, to 26th in California. And the presiding judge asked me if I would mind hearing criminal division cases at another location, that being Skokie, Illinois, a courthouse which had recently been completed. And there were four courtrooms in that building which were used by the criminal division to hear criminal cases. The cases assigned to me at Skokie were all Chicago criminal cases, all Chicago felony criminal cases, and they included a general variety of ordinary cases on the ordinary call, much the same as any call in 26th in California. I sat at that location for a number of years, and there were, of course, assignments within the criminal division that various judges, for any number of reasons, felt that they would like to move from one location or another, one courtroom in 26th of California to another courtroom, and these accommodations were made. There was a judge at 26th of California who wanted to move to a Skokie location because it was closer to his home.
Okay.
So he asked me if I had any problem with a change in courtroom from that locale at Skokie to 26th in California, and I had no problem with that. So I then went back to, or went over to 26th in California, sat in that courthouse for some time too.
What year did you move back to 26th?
I can't give you an exact figure in it. It was late 80s or early. And I said 26th in California for about 1992. And then I left there and spent 2 years basically with, either in the divorce division, I think they call it the domestic relations division.
Mm-hmm.
And the first municipal district criminal division, which is a misdemeanor.
Okay.
I did that because I was ailing at the time. And, I just didn't want to be home. Follow me down to 26th in California, Florida, as you're getting back and forth to Daly Center.
Right.
So that's basically where my assignments.
Well, there were a few cases that came up during the course of your career that we wanted to talk about. Not mostly because of how you could reflect on particular issues of the law and your career through them. One of them was one involving a young man named Billy Graves, and we talked about it before, and we don't have a lot of the details on it, but it was a case where somebody who was adjudged by a psychiatrist to be recommended as an inpatient patient ended up in the justice system. And I was wondering if you could expand on any of your feelings or any of your opinions on how people with mental illness have been treated by the justice system as you've seen it in Cook County, and any other specific instances you might think of that do come to mind that illustrate your opinions on that.
Well, I have at this point no specific recollection of the defendant.
Graves.
Is that Billy Graves, you say?
Billy Graves.
Yeah. I'm unable to recollect specifically that case at this time, but I had countless numbers of cases, thousands upon thousands of cases, mm-hmm. and I had a large number of different dispositions. My dispositions in the criminal division are available for your perusal in the records of the criminal division of the Circuit Court of Cook County. When I left the recidivist call, when I was on a recidivist call, the number of dispositions I had annually, I believe, were very large, given the fact that almost every case went to a jury trial,
mm-hmm.
And I was constantly in trial. Many cases are disposed of by police of guilty in the criminal division, and most cases are disposed of by police of guilty in the criminal division, far greater number
yeah.
of cases. So that when I left that section at the recidivist call within the criminal division and had a regular call in the criminal division, I believe I had probably, if not the highest, next to the highest number of dispositions annually in the criminal division. And that was by virtue of the fact that I had many, many bench trials and a tremendous number of police of guilty. I would listen to factual situation and tell lawyers based upon the prosecution of the state had told me what I felt was an appropriate disposition of the case, and that's how most of those cases were resolved. Now, with that going on, I have no particular recollection of many, many of these cases.
Right.
Unless for some reason, you know, I could see the material and reflect on it, and then I'm sure that my recollection will come back in many of these cases, but mm-hmm. specifically with respect to this individual called Billy Graves, I don't.
Okay.
However, I've seen many individuals who were in the criminal justice system here in Cook County, and I see this as both as a judge and as a lawyer, as a prosecutor and as a defense lawyer. Many of these individuals are poor souls in every sense of the word. There's a lot of question in my mind as to whether or not many of them really belong in the criminal justice system and being dealt with as they are should more appropriately be dealt with in mental institutions and other programs outside of Department of Corrections or possibly even outside of institutionalization within the Department of Mental Health.
Mm-hmm.
The Department of Mental Health has a budget in Illinois, and as all things happen, sometimes it's strained, and individuals are medicated, as we like to say. State, they are sent to the Department of Mental Health, and they need mental treatment. But there are certain parameters in which they can be institutionalized within the Department of Mental Health against their will. The United States Supreme Court has held that unless an individual is a threat to himself or to others, hold.
Right.
So they can walk in, and if medically doctor says, well, this individual is being medicated. I believe right now he is in contact with the reality.
Mm-hmm.
And then he turns around and says, well, okay, doc, I'm going to leave. Get out of here.
Yeah.
You can't restrain him. You can't keep him in there. This is, I'm talking about now individuals that are in need of mental treatment.
Yeah.
Although these are... The psychiatrists say that, well, if the individual's acting appropriately, and I've come to see that acting appropriately in society means I'm not hitting you over the head, bouncing a bat against your skull.
Right.
And, otherwise, I'm not bothering you, sir. Then I'm acting appropriately, but I might be stalled.
Right.
I'm acting appropriately. I'm not being aggressive or offensive, maybe.
Yeah.
We say that so that individuals are often involuntarily admitted to the Illinois Department of Corrections, so to speak, taken to something like the Reed Zone Center for a few hours, and then they're seen by a doctor and later by a judge, and the judge, on the basis of the psychiatrist's recommendation, says that this fellow is okay, we're acting appropriately, so to speak. He's not going to be a threat to himself or to others at the moment, as long as he takes his medication.
Right.
And so they get back into medication and send him back up the street. Mm-hmm. Now, there's all kinds of mental illness. You know, some fellow thinks he's the king of Siams. You know, or, you know, he's very happy being the king of Siam.
Yeah.
He's not so happy. He's not so happy walking around the street with a full and dealing with the reality that he's unemployed.
Yeah.
That people are picking on him. That he hasn't got much money. That his prospects for getting a job aren't very good. Mm-hmm. He doesn't like working over there at that restaurant where he's washing the dishes and cleaning up after people. Mm-hmm. This is not his idea. He wants to do in life. He's got a halfway decent education, and he's not happy with this.
Yeah.
So, you know, he just falls back in a thing. He's not taking his medication after a little while. And now he's sitting over in the corner, and he's quite content to live in this other world that he's in when he's not being medicated, so to speak. So he becomes a victim oftentimes of people that prey on the Department of Mental Health. There's a bunch of social workers, and they say, okay, look, John, we're going to get you an apartment over here on Kenmore or Winthrop. And as a matter of fact, in this neighborhood, we're very close to those two quarters. They take Susie and Johnny and so on and so forth over there because Susie's sister, Tilly, lives in Park Ridge. And Tilly's a very nice woman, but she's had Susie over there with her when, on many occasions in the past, but her husband, George, says that Tilly isn't, or Susie isn't coming back in this house again, or I'm leaving. So now Susie got anybody that's going to take her in. This is a practical matter, and it's something you got to deal with, particularly in the city of Chicago. So Susie is housed over here on Kenmore, the area is getting smaller and smaller geographically. They used to go all the way down to Irving Park, but now they're rehabbing the south end of that. They got all kinds of developers that have come in and knock buildings down and are rehabbing three flats and six flats that used to be used in that end to house these people. Now they're up at the heavily in the north end.
Much more concentrated.
Yeah, they're much more concentrated. And, so she's up there. Susie is now ensconced in an apartment. The state of Illinois is paying some of the money, and she's getting on, and she's getting fine. She gets her money, and her next-door neighbor is somebody from the Department of Corrections who is going through the social services in the Department of Corrections, and